Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to talk about something fascinating, something gripping. We're going to talk about cables. Now, I know initially that is not something that you might think would be a very interesting topic, but as Feynman once said, everything is interesting if you look closely enough. And that is the case with fibre optic cables. We're going to be talking all about that in a bit with Professor David Webb from Aston University in the UK. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're at @NewstalkScience. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady from the DCU Insight Research Ireland Centre for Data Analytics and Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD. You're both very welcome. Shelley, our first story has to do with smart sanitary pads. And this is timely because this week was World Menstrual Hygiene Day.
Yep. So this project is called Menstrue AI. And there's researchers at ETH Zurich have developed an innovative technology called Menstrue AI. So what this does, it integrates rapid test strips into sanitary pads and it detects the health biomarkers in menstrual blood. So it claims to offer a non-invasive, convenient methods for individuals to monitor their health during the menstrual cycle. And it's designed to enable users to check their health regularly. Now, I guess it's fantastic because 1.8 billion individuals menstruate on the planet, but menstrual blood hardly ever plays a role in medicine and diagnosis. So what the researchers say is that this reflects a systemic lack of interest in women's health. And what they want to do is stop viewing menstrual blood as waste and show that it is a valuable source of information.
So this is a real challenge, right? Because this is an area where there's exchange of fluids, is often then a worry about infection. And there have been products in the past that have caused some serious problems. Mm-hmm. This is just early sort of testing. What are they looking for?
So it's feasibility. The feasibility testing has gone on and they are looking to look at a larger sample of people and to roll this out. But basically what they're looking at is there's the same biomarkers are within the venous blood that's in a standard blood test. So you've got the C-reactive protein for inflammation and then another one called CA125. So that's used to monitor conditions like ovarian cancer. And the way it works is within the sanitary pad, and they're saying that you can actually integrate this in within a standard sanitary pad as well, that you don't need to purchase special sanitary pads. There's a rapid test strip. And when the blood contacts this test strip, it reacts with the antibodies and it will change colour. The change in the colour will vary depending on the concentration of the corresponding protein that we mentioned already.
Right.
And the higher the concentration, the darker the colour will be. You will be able to look at it and with the naked eye see the changes in color and have a diagnosis there. You don't need a lab for this. It's right there. But what they have paired it with is an app that you can take a photograph of the sanitary pad and then the app will actually provide you with that diagnosis.
Which is good as long as the data is accurate.
Absolutely.
Right? And obviously when we're looking at that, you know, even 90% is nowhere near good enough. It needs to be very, very accurate. What sort of numbers are they getting?
So they didn't actually say that in the article, but what they are looking at is the fact that this is in no way a substitute for medical advice. There's nice motivation behind this project because they're looking at putting women's health in a place it deserves to be, being cost effective, and being used in regions with poor healthcare, but it is in no way intended to replace that established diagnostics system, but it does serve as a potential early warning so people can get into the medical service when they need to.
I mean, obviously screening all the time, it has its own problems, but, you know, if it's not too expensive and could, you know, identify early on some of these biomarkers for cancer, that'd be fantastic.
Absolutely. And I suppose, like you say, being able to monitor health progression over long term and understand any changes, that's great. But there is that piece around period poverty. So it's commendable. It's a great contribution, an attempt at breaking down these barriers for more equitable health. But if we consider statistics that have come out of the Healthy Ireland survey recently, I think it's 24% of women in Ireland, 500 million women and girls worldwide have experienced at least one indicator of period poverty. So if they can't afford that normal sanitary pads, will they be able to afford these smart pads? And look, maybe Menstrue AI have thought about that, and maybe they're looking at making it a more affordable, you know, widely available sanitary product, which would be fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, our second story, Shane, has to do with sleep apnea, which is something that my mum suffers for, and the poor woman has to wear one of these elephant tine devices on her face when she goes to bed. It's actually an awful thing to be subjected to, because you fall asleep and then you wake up again. You fall asleep and you wake up again. So it's horrific. Shane, this is your story. Tell me about this research.
Yeah, this is a new medicinal approach to treating obstructive sleep apnea. And as you said, people have to wear rather cumbersome machines to apply continuous positive airway pressure so that the muscles in their throat stay active and they effectively keep breathing, because people with this condition wake up continuously during the night because they stop breathing and their oxygen levels decrease, sometimes to dangerous levels, and then they become awake either consciously or unconsciously. And it affects millions of people around the world. And the best treatment at the moment is that rather cumbersome machine. So as you can imagine, there's been a great excitement at the success of a recent clinical trial, which uses a combination of two drugs to keep the muscles in the airways active during sleep so that people are able to continue to breathe normally.
What are these drugs and who is behind this research?
So the research has been published in Science, and it's been led by a private company in the United States. And they're going through the rather rigorous regulatory process in the United States to have this approved by the federal drug agency, the FDA. What's cool about this is they use a combination of two existing drugs. One is a stimulant that effectively keeps this rather large muscle called the genioglossus active in the throat, and the other then the second drug prevents that muscle from effectively relaxing during the night. So it keeps it going so that you don't fall into the regular patterns of sleep apnea. And it's remarkable, because then, like, imagine somebody like your mother not having to have this very cumbersome machine, and they end up kind of just living with sleep apnea. But it can, of course, lead to increased risk of stroke and Alzheimer's and other conditions for unknown reasons.
Well, I mean, unknown in some ways, and the other way, I mean, starving the brain of oxygen every single night is probably not a great habit to have. But, like, you know, when you think of the therapeutic treatment that they've come up with to solve, you know, someone not being able to sleep is attaching them to a large mechanical elephant head. I mean, that also is not a great treatment. So it's great to hear about this therapy. Hopefully it passes FDA approval and is safe to take, because it would make a big difference to people's lives. Shelley, our third story has to do with predicting volcanic eruptions.
Yeah, so this is a really exciting, innovative piece of work between NASA and the Smithsonian Institute. So what scientists are doing is they are trying to predict volcanic eruptions by monitoring plant life, especially trees, that grow near active volcanoes. And they're doing this from space using satellites to detect subtle changes in the vegetation, in particular the greening of leaves. And that is serving as an indicator of volcanic activity. So it's really all about going back to nature and listening to nature, that it is always telling us something.
How do these trees predict earthquakes?
So it all centres around carbon dioxide. So what happens is, as the magma is rising beneath the volcano, it releases CO2 into the soil. And what they think happens is the trees may be absorbing the CO2 through the roots, and then that stimulates photosynthesis and it leads to lusher, greener foliage. And what they're doing is, because there's been such huge advances in satellite detection, they're able to measure these effects from space. So the vegetation health is providing a visual cue of increased volcanic activity, and it's indirect, but it is quantifiable and it's measurable. So it's able to show us what's happening subsurface.
That's really cool.
Really cool. And I suppose what they're doing is they're showing that it's not just the satellite alone. That's not good enough, but it's allowing people to see, okay, look, where may there be some volcanic activity happening? And then they're able to go in and do ground observations. So field staff will go in, take leaf samples, obtain the measurements of the CO2 near the volcanoes. So then they can verify whether these vegetation changes are accurate.
That's the idea that you would be able to detect that from space,
yeah,
like the changes in lushness of vegetation, and go, looks like there's more CO2 in those roots and leading to lush vegetation. It's very, very cool.
Yeah, it is.
There are reports that animals can tell hours before volcanoes erupting, like 8 hours before you see unusual activity of animals in a particular area, you know, either running to or from forests and so on. So it's kind of, we like to think that we're very smart and we have all these ways of detecting things around the world, but actually nature is a lot smarter sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our final story, Shane, has to do with supervision. What is this?
A new form of contact lens that gives humans supervision. It allows them to see beyond the visible spectrum of light that our eyes can detect using the cones that we have in our eyes. So not only will you be able to see red, green, blue and all the combinations therein, you'll also be able to see slightly into the infrared, like snakes and vampire bats and even some fish that use these colours of light that we can't see. Amazing. And they do this using contact lenses that have nanoparticles in them. And the nanoparticles do something called upscaling, or upconversion rather. So they take in infrared light and they are able to translate that into visible light that you can see. You're able to detect new signals, new things. And in the study that was published in Cell recently, they built on work that had been done previously by the same group, where they actually embedded the nanoparticles into the retina of mice. But for obvious reasons, humans weren't going to do that. So they put the nanoparticles into the lenses, and then they used a series of sort of infrared flashes, like Morse code, to see whether people were able to see infrared. And it's kind of, you know, how sharp they were able to see it. Unfortunately, though, they're only able to see into the near infrared. So they're only able to see some of that redder end of the spectrum. They're not yet able to see into the far infrared, which we would associate with night vision goggles and being able to kind of see those kind of thermal signatures that bodies give off. Because if you look at the heat signatures we all give off, which are very strong in the infrared, we're able to tell hot from cold, as we see in all those great police chase TV shows.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, to be able to see in the dark has many applications, although, you know, I know DARPA has spent a lot of money trying to figure that out for the worst possible application of science, war, of course. But there are lots of applications where being able to see in the dark would be very, very useful. Coming home from a lecture picnic for people is one of them. That's my application for this technology. How far are they away from actually creating something that might be useful, Shane, or is this very much basic research at the moment?
No, this is beyond basic research. So the work is done in the University of Science and Technology of China, and they're almost at commercial stage. Now, whether that technology would be approved for use in the European Union is a whole other day's work. As anything that had nanoparticles in it, I did my PhD in this area, one always has to be careful about how those nanoparticles might end up in the body and what harm they might cause. Because of their size, they're often associated potentially with forming cancer. So care will be needed to figure out the impacts of wearing them. But the technology works. They're embedded in the lenses. In theory, you could just go into this professor's lab and pop them in and they would work for you. The question is are they commercially viable and are they safe enough for us to use? But maybe soon, who knows? I bet you'd be willing to try.
Yeah, probably would, to be honest. I'll give anything a go, Shane, you know me. All right, thanks very much. Shane Bergen from UCT and from the DCU Insight Centre for Data Analytics, Dr. Shelley Brady. Now, you've probably got fiber optic cables running into your home, but what if those cables could also listen for things deep under the sea? Well, joining us now is Professor David Webb. He's Professorial Research Fellow at Aston Institute of Photonic Technologies at Aston University in the UK. Welcome to the programme, David. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Good, good. So let's start off with some simple stuff. How does a fiber optic cable work?
Okay, so a fiber optic cable essentially made out of glass. It's a cylinder of glass, but when I say a cylinder, it's only about the size of a human hair, the diameter of a human hair. And it works by light being launched into one end of the fiber. And if you do so correctly, the light will bounce down the fiber continually until it comes out of the other end. And so in a communication system, That light is modulated. That is to say, the laser that's producing the light is turned on and off to produce the ones and zeros that make up a digital signal. They travel down the fiber as pulses, and at the other end, they're picked up by a receiver and transfer back into the electronic domain.
So I know that to be true, and at the same time, it sounds like complete nonsense for a number of reasons, right? These cables, you can twist them round. How come the glass doesn't break for the first question?
Well, that's a misconception that glass is fragile, and it's not, in fact. If you were to take one of these fibres, and as I say, it's about 125 microns across, the size of a human hair, very thin. If you wrap it around your hands and try and break it, you will struggle. So it's actually very rugged. And the reason you can bend it around a pencil or something like that is just because it's so very, very thin. Now, the proviso around all this is that if you get any kind of scratch or mark on the fiber, then it becomes very, very weak and will break. And that's why when we produce optical fibers, we give them a little plastic coating to stop anything scratching the fiber. It's like if you want to cut a window pane. You do so by scratching it with a diamond stylus, and then the glass will hopefully break where you've drawn that line.
That I understand. The next part is, if we think of the speed at which we can transfer data across a fiber optic cable, and that data is zeros and ones, and that a single byte is it would be one of these. And we think about kilobytes to megabytes to gigabytes to terabytes. How on earth can one wire take that amount of information? What is happening with this light on one end that is flicking on and off? Like, how could it possibly transmit that amount of information in a second? We think of like a 4K movie easily can pass through a fiber optic cable, each of those frames, and that's only passed by a light going on and off to signify ones and zeros that then is translated into a full gigabyte of information in a very short space of time. How is that possible?
Yeah, well, firstly, let me just say that's a really good question. And in fact, the amount of fiber that we've been able to send down, the amount of data we've been able to send down optical fibers has been growing exponentially since they were introduced, around about 1980. Back in 1980, the most number of bits per second we could send down a fiber was about 100 megabits, something like that. And I was looking up on the internet before this chat that's roughly the average now of what a home in Ireland can get for themselves, not the total capacity of the fiber. So we were 100 megabits per second in 1980. In my own institution, we were the team that last year got a record for the current highest number of bits down a fiber, and that was 400 terabytes per second, which is roughly 4 million broadband channels for Ireland if you wanted to send them all down one fiber. So it's an interesting question, which I haven't answered yet. I realize that. And the real answer, there are an awful lot of tricks going on in order to get those numbers up and up and up. It's not just simply a case of making the pulses faster and faster and faster. So just to give you an idea of some of the tricks that go on, the first one is that instead of just using one laser to send light down the fiber, so one wavelength or one color, if you like, we actually use many, many lasers, so many tens of lasers. So if instead of using one laser, you use 20 lasers, then of course you can send 20 times as much information at the same time.
But you said this is the width of a single hair and it's glass. How can you send 20 lasers down one single hair of glass?
Okay, so it is a technological challenge actually getting all the lasers in there. light from
I would
all
imagine.
The lasers in there. and we do that by creating filters or mirrors, let's call them mirrors, that are wavelength selective. So this gives us a way of combining lots of lasers which are very closely spaced in wavelength, in color. They're only sort of a fraction of a nanometer apart, if people understand nanometers. We do this by having very, very precise filters that will allow us to combine all these into a single fiber. and then they travel down the fibre. I mean, that's just one trick. You know, that will get your number of bits up by a factor of 10 or a factor of 100. It doesn't get it up by a factor of 4 million or whatever it was from the 1980s. So there are other cunning tricks. So instead of just turning the laser on and off, so 0 and 1, no light or light, the systems now actually use a multi-level approach. So the laser, rather than just being turned on to one brightness, they're actually a stack of brightnesses. So if you have eight different levels there, then you can essentially send three bits at once instead of one bit. So that gets you some more amplification, some more gain in the amount of bits you can send. There are also a lot of problems to solve. If you just make the pulses shorter and shorter, you start running into a problem known as dispersion. And there's some fundamental physics in the optical fiber that mean that if you send a really, really, really short pulse down that fiber, it will tend to spread out. So if you start off with lots of ones and zeros, pulses and absences of pulses, when it travels, you know, 80 kilometers or something like that, they all overlap coming out of the other end.
Right.
There's been a lot of technological work gone into trying to unravel that and get yourself back to the nice, neat signal that you started with.
Oh, so you can't even just go faster and faster and shorter zeros and ones. You can't even though it's technically possible to do shorter bursts, that doesn't work because of the physics of the cable.
Yeah. So that's the problem. If you use shorter and shorter pulses as well, then the amount of energy in each pulse will be less, and that gives you signal-to-noise problems. It becomes harder to detect the pulses. One way around that is to turn up the power of the laser. If you do that, you run into yet other problems because you start to get non-linearities that start to make the individual wavelengths interact with each other, so you get crosstalk. So it's a hugely complicated problem that you know might at the outset sound relatively simple. You bounce a light down a fiber, but if you want to get up to 400 terabits per second, you've got a lot of problems to solve on the way, and that's why it's taking 40 years.
But I think you know people listening to this program have no idea how difficult it is to grow the exponential speed of these cables every year by so much. There's an enormous amount of physics and engineering required to produce these things, and yet we totally take it for granted. But when it comes to fiber optic cables, they underpin the entire internet, right? I mean, fiber optics we depend on it for everything.
That's right. I mean, people are more familiar with it now because we're starting to see a lot more fiber to the home, and fiber broadband is a sort of big thing. But even, you know, 30 years ago, you couldn't really have the internet without all those fiber cables, particularly the ones that go under the sea. You know, you're sending these pulses of light without turning them back into electricity. You're sending them, thousands of kilometers.
What?
Are they that long? Yeah. Well, if you're going from Ireland to Newfoundland, that's a few thousand kilometers. Yeah.
There'll be stops along the way, surely.
Ah, no, well, this was another one of the developments that's made things a lot easier in some ways. In the earlier days, so the problem is that glass is not completely transparent, glass fibers. I mean, the optical fibers are super pure. I did some rough calculations, and I think they're roughly a million times more transparent than a window pane, if I can put it like that.
Hmm.
So the light in an optical fiber, if it travels 15 kilometers, you lose only about half of it. Nevertheless, if you want to go from Ireland to America and you just have a single optical fiber, you'll get nothing left that you can actually see at the other end. So this is where your question came in. You know, originally, you would have had to, every 100 kilometers or so on that cable, you would have had to have a little electronic unit that detected what little light was left, amplified it up, and then you'd have another laser to send the light into the next bit of fiber.
Yeah, like a Wi-Fi booster.
Yeah. But one of the key breakthroughs in the mid-80s was the invention of all optical amplification. So on these nodes now, every 80 kilometers or so, there's some special fiber that's doped with one of the rare earths, typically erbium. And this is a kind of material from which you can make a laser, which is to do with amplifying light. So what you do is you pump this fiber, you provide it with energy from a local laser at a different wavelength, but then your signal light comes in and it just gets amplified as an optical signal. So you never need to turn it into an electronic one.
And this happens underneath at the very bottom of the ocean bed.
Yeah, these cables that are laid, you know, as I said, up to several thousand kilometers long. In the most extreme cases, they have a little pod. They vary a bit. It's about the length of your arm span. It might be sort of 10, 20 centimeters across.
My God.
And in that is the electronics that you need to drive the laser and to pump this fiber that's acting as an amplifier. And that's built to last 25 years at the bottom of the sea, which is also no mean engineering feat.
It's actually extraordinary when you think about all of the things that go into something that we just pick up our phone, we just look at the, you know, TikTok or whatever. So these cables, presumably, if they get cut like any other cable, you've got problems with them, and that they're of interest, I would imagine, in espionage as well. Could I sniff an optic cable? Not literally, obviously, but I mean, could I, if I was a Russian spy, for example, could I go down to one of these optical cables, cut the cable, and then stick something in between to relay back to me, and then stick the two cables back together before anyone would notice?
That would be pretty difficult. Cables are, well, they represent a tremendous investment. You know, it's not cheap to lay a cable between Ireland and America. And they recoup that investment by having an awful lot of data flowing down that cable that has to be paid for. And so there are all kind of monitoring schemes that are in there. So if there is a break, the alarms will be flashing very quickly before anybody can stick it back together. The main issue around what you're talking about there, though, is that, as I say, these cables are tremendous economic resources. And whilst in the past there has been damage from ships inadvertently dragging their anchor across the cable or bottom trawlers catching the cable, and they should know where the cables are, you know, they have maps, but nevertheless accidents happen. But you've probably seen in the news more recently that there's an increasing case of, shall we say, hostile actors that like to cut cables to cause economic damage.
Yeah. Staying within the spy realm, it is possible to use these fiber optic cables in a different way, given how incredibly sensitive they are to change. And this is something that you're working on, the idea that we could actually use the cables as sensors. Talk to me about this research.
Yeah, that's currently a hot topic, and I'm coordinating a European project in this area. Now, people have realized that these cables, particularly, well, not just the ones across the ocean floor, you know, there's about 1.5 million kilometers, I think it is, of cables of fiber in the ocean. But on the land there has been produced, it's not all been used, but people have produced about 5 billion kilometers. So all the fiber that's been produced in the world could reach beyond Neptune. So we're talking about a lot of fiber here.
Wow.
People have realized that, yes, wow.
That's insane.
People have realized that all these thousands or millions of kilometers of fiber that are currently being used for communications, in principle, gives you a globe-spanning network if we could turn them into sensors. And so the project that we're working on is looking at two aspects of that. One of it relates to the undersea fibers, where the aim is to be able to use the fibers to detect very faint vibrations that are associated with seismic activity.
Because when you talk about seismic activity or you know, nuclear submarines coming close or anything that makes a vibration or noise that might be picked up by a sensor, I would understand how that would work if it was a sensor, but it's a wire of glass. How would you be able to detect these things with something like that? There's no mechanism in it.
Oh, yes, there are always mechanisms. So what you're basically making use of is the fact that if you get some environmental perturbation, whether it's the ground shaking or whether it's somebody hitting the cable with an axe or whatever, that causes a bit of strain in the glass. And what that means is that that causes the glass to get slightly longer or slightly shorter, compression and tension in the glass. So that's what we're looking to measure. And, you know, these are, as you can probably appreciate, very, very small signals. We're not talking about much change to the glass. But one of the features of, well, there are various ways of doing this, but for example, one of the features of light is it's a wave. So like all waves, it's got peaks and troughs. Mm. You can think of a water wave. And one of the characteristics of waves is the phase, so the position of these peaks and troughs. Now, if you perturb the glass, if you stretch the glass, then that phase changes, and that's something you can monitor at the end of the cable.
Oh, right. So if there's an earthquake, the cable gets stretched, and the wave at that particular moment in that particular space will appear slightly different.
Yes, that's basically it. So, and that's a very sensitive approach. Now, as I've described it, you're looking at the light that's travelled down the fibre and you've received it and you've noticed a phase change. The problem with that approach is it doesn't tell you where on that link it is. Mm. So if you're going across the Atlantic, it's nice to know something's happened, but it's a bit frustrating not to know where in those thousands of kilometres it has happened.
Yeah.
But there are other approaches that will actually give you that positional information. So there are approaches which are a kind of the light version of radar. You know, with radar, you send out a pulse, it bounces off a plane and comes back, and you know where the plane is by how long it's taken the pulse to go there and come back.
Yeah.
So there are some very clever techniques with glass. Having told you how super transparent it is, it's not 100% transparent. And in fact, a very, very tiny amount of the light that you send down gets scattered backwards and comes back towards the laser.
Hmm.
And so if you perturb the fiber somewhere, that scattering process gets perturbed. And by the round trip time, you can get a good estimate to within, you know, tens of meters or sometimes even less than 10 meter of where that perturbation has happened.
That's really cool. And I think if we figured out how to do that, it would be really interesting, because understanding seismic activity at the bottom of the ocean is a very difficult thing to do. But I wanted to ask you one final thing, and that was to do with space. So if we think about these fiber optic transmitters and receivers, they work really well because glass is incredibly pure, 1 million times the transparency of a window pane. But if we go into space and we have the same technology without the fiber, because there's nothing in space, and so the transmission path is absolutely clear, would that get you to maximum possible transmission and receiving speeds? Or is there something else that stops space being a wonderful place to transmit data at the highest possible speeds?
Space is a wonderful place to transmit. We've talked about lots of technological challenges that you have to solve on Earth, and many of them are to do with absorption and having to put amplifiers and things. Mm. You're quite right that's not really an issue in space. What you do have, though, is lots of objects that are moving extremely quickly relative to each other. So the challenge in space is pointing your laser at the target.
Mm.
And that is a challenge that is being solved. And actually, there are more demonstrators than you know, actual use of the technology, but there are flying demonstrators in space now where satellites are communicating with each other optically. That gives them much, much greater bandwidth, you know, much more information can be sent. And you've got a security angle because you have to be in the line of the beam to be able to pick it up. Whereas radio, of course, spreads out.
Yeah, you can sort of listen in. Who knew that cables were so fascinating? Thank you so much for speaking with us in the program. Professor David Webb is from Aston University in the United Kingdom. All right, time for some of your comments on last week's program. And if you were listening, we did a documentary produced and edited and written by Aidan McKelvey. I basically voiced the thing, but it was a huge labour of love for him, and I thought it sounded fantastic. So huge congratulations to Aidan. And it was about Are We Alone in the Universe, and trying to figure out the various parts of Drake's equation. Frank Drake was an astronomer, and he was trying to figure out whether or not we could figure out some sort of mathematical equation to whether or not we were likely to ever come in contact with an intelligent species. And we have an email in from John Murphy. He's a physics teacher in Regina Mundi College in Cork. And he says this thing, and I'm actually so curious as to what he's talking about. He says, really enjoying your show on the search for alien life. I just thought I'd mention Ireland's exoplanet and its host star, Bran and Turin. I was lucky enough to name them. I don't know what you mean, John. How does Ireland have an exoplanet? And how does that exoplanet that Ireland has have a host star? I need to know more. Moraes, we need to get in contact with him, please. Because that sounds like a very interesting story. Jeremy on Twitter says, absolutely, 100% there are other life forms in the universe. We may never meet them for whatever reason, but it would be beyond chance that our planet alone has life. Absence of evidence isn't as evidence of absence. No, Jeremy, but like in the documentary, I had no idea that it is believed that there was just one single event that enzymes or amino acids mixed together, and that in this one single event across the entire planet, not like a species or just one single event at one point in time, 3 billion years ago, something ate itself, created what started to be some sort of nucleus, and all of a sudden we had the very beginnings of life. The fact that was just one thing, that made me sort of question. As I said in the documentary, I started off thinking, oh yeah, there's loads of life out there. But by the end, I wasn't sure. If you haven't heard it, do take a listen. I thought it was great. Patrick also on Twitter says, what would we do if there was life outside Earth? As we've always done, colonize, I suppose. It's what we've done on this planet. We can't live together here. We sure as hell ain't going to be nice to anyone else should there be some out there. We destroy the planet we have looking for another. Yeah, look, I totally agree. I mean, you know, if you want to fix the planet's problems, take out the human race is one way of doing it, although it's not a popular opinion. but I don't know. I think we found aliens. I don't think we'd kill them, at least not straight away. I don't know. It would just be you've seen it so many times in movies, it's hard to imagine how the world would respond to that knowledge. You know, if a UFO or if we spotted, you know, some form of life far, far away, it would just be huge. And yet the chances of it seem to be, there must be something else out there. That was the question. If you haven't heard the documentary, as I say, you should take a listen. That's it from us on this episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo de Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.